It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today it's Thanksgivings for all, from the vores, as in the vegivores, carnivores, and omnivores, to the legions of first-timers. Let's face it. I mean, who cooks 20 pounds of bird on a regular basis? It's intimidating. Well, for newbies, no white-knuckling your way through this turkey day, because easy is the middle name of every menu and idea you're going to hear today. For old hands, we've got new adventures. For example, an amazingly fragrant Mexican turkey slow-cooked in banana leaves. The vegetarian grand dame Molly Katzen has a feast for everyone. The gang at the Kitchen Blog delivers a swanky do-ahead menu. We've got magical pie crust and perfect wines and lots more. So stay with us for all this and your calls this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Molly Katzen is one of the best-selling cookbook authors of all time. She has 6 million volumes in print to prove it. So what does she write about? Well, vegetarian cooking. Starting 40 years ago, Molly raised the consciousness of an entire generation. That's when she helped found the Moosewood Collective in Syracuse, New York. Now, at a time when yogurt and tofu were wildly exotic, their first book, The Moosewood Cookbook, opened minds and turned on palates. Well, she left Moosewood many years ago, but never left her love of vegetarian cooking. Her latest book is The Heart of the Plate. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked with Molly about what 4 decades has done for her food.
Molly, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Sally.
So tell me, you were literally at the forefront of vegetarian cuisine 40 years ago when you wrote that first cookbook based on the restaurant, the Moosewood Cookbook.
Little did I know at the time. I was just cooking and trying to find a
and
way to eat plant food.
Off it goes, 40 years later.
Really, yes.
How has vegetarian food changed in those years?
I think one of the things we were trying to do early on, at least I know I was just find a substitute for that hunk of meat in the center mm-hmm. of the plate. So it was very focused on something that could convince people that it was enough, you know, a substantial enough hunk of something to replace the hunk of meat. Very often that took the form of a casserole, something bound up with cheese or custard or eggs or all of the above. And it was largely about that main course. It wasn't, strangely enough, necessarily about vegetables. It was about finding something substantial enough to hold down the plate.
Which is a totally different take now.
Totally different take, because now it's about find a beautiful framework for the vegetables themselves. The vegetables really were still relegated to the side as they would be on a meat plate, except that the meat was replaced by the vegetarian casserole.
Do you think vegetables are harder to cook than meat?
Oh, gosh, no. I don't. I think that there are some people who fear that they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that I can understand that, because the idea of cooking meat for a lot of people is it's very straightforward and it's very quick. But with vegetables, there's always the issue of the knife. And there's also the issue of procuring.
What do you mean, the issue of the knife?
Well, in many cases, vegetables need to be chopped, trimmed, peeled, something. You know, they're not necessarily ready to go into the pan. And I think that a lot of people have a bit of insecurity around the use of a knife. I call it the knife block. So that if people get over that and can bond with a good knife, everything changes.
That's interesting. I had never thought about that with vegetables.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving, because, of course, it's the meal that I think many vegetarians feel left out. Have you felt left out as a vegetarian?
No, but I've never been a strict vegetarian. I'll always take a little bite of this or that. My personal vegetarianism is mostly about the fact that I put so much plant food on my own plate that there's no room for anything else. I think there's a lot of angst in kind of mythology around, oh, poor vegetarians, what will they do for Thanksgiving? Because in fact, I see Thanksgiving as a vegetarian's paradise, just doing nothing special, just the usual vegetarian dishes, the classic, the mashed potatoes, and then the mashed sweet potatoes, and then the cranberries and the Brussels sprouts, and maybe the Brussels sprouts and the green bean almondine and And then the dressing, if it's not cooked inside the turkey, and it's okay for a vegetarian. And then the key point, which is the gravy. See, I think people are
more... Yeah, you have a take on gravy.
I do. And I think the thing that people really love about the Thanksgiving meal really is the gravy more than even the turkey. I think it's the gravy.
How do we go about making a gravy?
Well, in fact, I have a recipe in my newest book. It's a mushroom gravy. I call it mushroom gravy for everyone because, in fact, it is not only vegetarian, but it's vegan. It's also gluten-free because for people who can't eat gluten, gravy is another issue because it's often thickened with flour. Mm-hmm. So this is a mushroom gravy that is largely mushrooms. When you cook mushrooms, any kind of mushroom, and it's so much fun to combine different kinds of mushrooms in the pot. Mushrooms have such a high percentage of water that when you cook them in such a way that they sweat out their natural juices by, you know, salting them as they cook, you get this beautiful mushroomy liquid.
It's the beginning of your gravy. So you're using fresh mushrooms here or dried?
Yeah. You can use both, but I use fresh and I use olive oil. Olive oil is just, I have become, if you could ask me for two words to describe the change in my cooking in the last 40 years, it would be olive oil. that's about it. And onion, you want to infuse, you know, the oil with the onion. And I use a few dried herbs, the kind of classic Thanksgiving-y herbs like sage and thyme and some garlic. And then the mushrooms go in, and it's important to salt them while they're cooking. Not heavily, but just enough to pull out their juices. And the juices become the gravy. And then you thicken it with cornstarch instead of with flour, so it can be
gluten-free. And you're just using the juices, or are you pureeing everything then?
I'm also adding stock.
Okay.
And the interplay of the stock and the cornstarch, you get this nice thickness, and then the mushrooms just clutter it up beautifully. And once you have a tasty gravy, and this gravy is so convincing. I mean, I have tested this out on skeptics. It passes. It really does. Mm-hmm. It more than passes. Mm-hmm. Psychologically speaking, and so much about this whole Thanksgiving issue for vegetarians is psychological, I think. Mm-hmm. If you have the gravy, you're good. That's a good starting point. And the next thing you need is some kind of dressing or stuffing, because that's the other thing. People just feel so emotionally drawn to Thanksgiving over, and their Thanksgiving memories often, you know, have some kind of dressing moment in those memories. You know, I've got a beautiful one made with cornbread. First you make a cornbread and then you crumble it and make it into dressing. Another one with wild rice and pomegranates. Mm-hmm. And so that, with this gravy, you're very far along. However, another psychological need, I think, that might be why there's all the woe is me for vegetarians around Thanksgiving is we want some kind of visual centerpiece.
We need a pinnacle dish. That's what the turkey is for us.
I love that,
right?
You said pinnacle
dish. So what would you do for vegetarians?
You know, my favorite thing to do that just hits the spot is stuff a vegetable with whatever you do. Like, you made this beautiful cornbread stuffing, or you made this beautiful wild rice and pomegranate stuffing, and you have a baked half of an acorn squash, a beautiful, you know, the dark green skin that turns kind of black in the bright orange center, and that perfect little cavity that wants you to stuff it so badly. And you roast that acorn squash half and fill it, you know, brimming with one of these stuffings. Or you can stuff cabbage. Or you can stuff a grilled portobello with anything. Anyone served a grilled portobello is going to have a happy moment.
Well, and anything stuffed is festive. Let's be honest here.
Stuffing something makes somebody feel like this dish was handcrafted just for them. You fill it with something, and then it's like they feel loved. And isn't that what we want people to feel like when we serve them a plate of food?
That's exactly right. That's our Thanksgiving for us. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you very much, Sally.
Molly Katzen is the author of The Heart of the Plate, and she left us with a vegetarian Thanksgiving menu, complete with that mushroom gravy for everyone. You're going to find it all, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. And since you're already there, why not check out our latest ebook, Italian Holidays, Eating In with Lynn, at splendidtable.org. Patty Hinnich is a formidable Mexican cook and writer. She does Patty's Mexican Kitchen on PBS. But I hear that she has a turkey recipe. And for those who are looking for the exotic, this may be the answer. Patty Hinnich joins us from Washington, D.C. Patty, welcome.
So lovely to talk to you, Lynn. Thank you for having me on.
So tell me about this turkey. Is it Mexican?
This is an outrageous Mexican turkey. It is outrageous because not only of its rub and the marinade, but the way it's cooked. It has the spices from the Yucatan Peninsula. And the cuisine from the Yucatan Peninsula is like an outlier in Mexican cooking in that it has a lot of citrus. I combine orange juice, grapefruit juice, lime juice, and I mix it up with white distilled vinegar. And then the main ingredient in this marinade is achiote paste.
Now, what is achiote?
Okay, achiote paste is made with annatto seeds, those little red pebbles that have a very charming metallic taste, a little bit like saffron, pungent and strong. And in my mind, they seem to taste like brick color. And it has like a brick color.
But it does.
You know, whenever I say it has a metallic taste, people will make these eyes. But I'm like, it's a delicious metallic taste.
Okay, so and this is used a lot in the Caribbean as well.
Yes, the annatto seeds. And in the Caribbean and in Yucatan, Lynn, it's also known as the poor man's saffron because it's incredibly cheap and it has the same sort of coloring and the same sort of flavoring that's hard to describe. But the achiote paste, aside from having annatto seeds, it has a lot of herbs like oregano and cumin and allspice.
I see. So that all gets mixed up. And then how long is the turkey marinated in this?
So the turkey is marinated. You can marinate it as long as you want. But if you can manage to marinate it for 48 hours, that bird is going to be really happy and luxurious.
Okay.
So 48 hours is great. And then it also has charred onion and garlic, which it makes it really rustic. And then you sit the marinated bird on a bed of red onion and tomatoes, and you wrap it up in banana leaves. And you can find them in the frozen sections of Latin grocery stores or international grocery stores. And what the banana leaves do to this turkey is magic. When you open it up, it's fragrant and jungle-like and very aromatic, aside from making it incredibly moist.
So are you baking this in like a deep pot, or is it in a roasting pan wrapped in the leaves?
Okay, so I use a large roasting pan. I put my bed of vegetables, sit the turkey right on it, and then I wrap it up in the leaves and then cover it with aluminum foil, because what we're trying to do, Lynn, is to emulate the ancient cooking technique of cooking things in underground pits.
Ah, and this is going to keep all the juices in, and it's going to concentrate, right?
Exactly. It's going to keep all those juices in. It's going to concentrate. It's going to make it super moist. And then right at the end, half an hour before it's done, you remove the aluminum foil and the banana leaves. You put it in the oven back in for another 30 minutes, and then it's almost coming apart because it's so moist, but then you give it that last crisp. So when it comes out, it's really something to feast and to be joyful about.
And how do you serve it?
I like to make a pecan, chorizo, apple, and cornbread stuffing. And so I serve it with the stuffing. I put some stuffing inside of the turkey and some stuffing outside. And I serve it with sweet potatoes, and then I let my friends bring the other side dishes. You know, I fought to make this turkey for years, Lynn. I used to bring side dishes, you know, as a Mexican, to my American friends' Thanksgiving table. And one year I said, okay, guys, please let me bring the turkey.
And this is interesting because when did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States 15 years ago, and I had never heard the word Thanksgiving. It sounded very foreign to me, but I am very keen on embracing any holiday that can be embraced. And so I wanted to get into the Thanksgiving spirit, and I cooked a formal classic Thanksgiving meal for my husband many years until I decided to start giving some dishes, some Mexican spins and twists.
This is the thing, though, I think that is so wonderful about the holiday, that as people come to this country, the Thanksgiving dinner becomes a mixture of the foods that you're used to eating from wherever you've come from. Yeah, there has to be a turkey and maybe there has to be sweet potatoes or whatever. But I think the most exciting things are what happens when
you know, people like you start making a turkey the way you're used to making a turkey and then incorporate it rather than the one that we all, you know, the kind of thing we always do. Patty, thank you for sharing this.
Thank you so much, Lee.
And happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Patty Hinnich has written Patty's Mexican Table. Now, that Mexican Thanksgiving turkey with chorizo, pecan, apple, and cornbread stuffing, that recipe, well, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Stay with us for Ray Isles' Turkey Day Wine Primer and the absolutely easiest pie crust we have found to date. No kidding. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Do you think zombies are only on the screen? Well, check out the wine aisles the day before Thanksgiving. You'll see glassy-eyed souls, without these zombie skin problems, stumbling from shelf to shelf, trying not to look baffled or desperate. And they could be any one of us. Well, enter Ray Isle. He's the executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine and a leader of the anti-wine snob movement. Ray, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back.
Ray, there's a riot of flavors on a Thanksgiving table. So what do we need to know to choose the right wines that are going to go with those flavors?
Well, the turkey is really the simple one. I mean, everything goes with turkey because turkey, you know,
yeah.
often doesn't have a whole lot of flavor.
It's true.
You know, it's the easy guy on the table. The tough ones are where you're going from Brussels sprouts to mashed potatoes to sweet potatoes to, you know, green beans to cranberry sauce, which is high in acid. And my rule of thumb is pretty straightforward, which is that assuming you've got a big crowd coming, you're going to have people who automatically want white wine no matter what they're eating, and you're going to have some people who automatically want red wine no matter what they're eating. So you might as well put out two wines no matter what, so you can at least make everybody happy. And I think then the key thing is finding wines that really are that kind of all-purpose, go-with-everything wine. And to me, what that is are red wines that have a lot of flavor but don't have a huge amount of tannins, so they're not too astringent and don't have like massively high acidity and also aren't too alcoholic because you don't get to just get blown away at the table by
– Right. So we've just lost Cabernet Sauvignon.
You lost Cabernet. You lost like big Zinfandels. What I love for this is Pinot Noir, Beaujolais, Dolcetto from Italy, let's say, Cabernet Franc from the Loire, the sort of mid-weight – lighter in alcohol, but still bright flavors and some acidity. Because you really, you know, when you've got a big meal like that, you're going to have a lot of fat floating around
right,
in a sense.
Right.
You know, gravy, if nothing else. I mean, I don't know if you're like me, but basically gravy goes on everything.
I've always felt that that was a very wise idea.
Yeah. It's one of the best parts of the meal. So those kind of red wines really refresh your palate rather than kind of weigh it down. And additionally, they have the virtue, especially with things like, you know, Beaujolais, you can get terrific wines for $15 a bottle or so, which, you know, if you happen to be feeding 20 people, it's not a bad idea. White wines, you know, again, what I look for tend to be, you know, unoaked wines, not too heavy, a lot of bright acidity. My go-to at the moment is dry Riesling. You know, people tend to think of Riesling as sweet, but a lot of places, Australia, for instance, case in point, make gorgeous Rieslings that are just, you know, dry and crisp and not sweet at all. And you can get some spectacular wines for $15-$20 a bottle that go just with a, you know, extraordinary range of foods.
What if you want to go lower? You know, I'm just thinking if you do have 20, 30 people at the table and they like to drink, how low can you go and get a decent bottle?
You know, you can go under 10, especially, you know, one of the things to always keep in mind is, you know, if you buy wines by the case, not necessarily from grocery stores, but if you go to a wine store, typically if you buy a case of wine, 12 bottles, you know, there's usually a 10 to 15% discount right there,
right,
which is a handy thing to know. And you look at the holiday season, you're apt to be going through, you know, 12 bottles. The nice thing about wine is if you don't go through all of it, the wine's still good. It's not like it suddenly goes bad overnight.
Right.
It's not like buying too much butter or something.
Yeah.
You know,
it'll be there in January. It'll be
or too many turkeys.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, case in point, you know, one of the wines we just wrote up in our Thanksgiving issue is a Chianti La Maialina, 2010 Chianti, which is $11 a bottle. let's say you buy a case, you're down to like $9.50 a bottle. It's a very basic Chianti, so it's very light and crisp, you know, beautiful cherry fruit, spectacular wine to go with almost anything. Similarly, you know, actually Chenin Blanc from South Africa can be a great wine. Indaba Chenin Blanc 2012, we wrote that up in the magazine. And that's, you know, crisp, got a fair amount of flavor, fair amount of body. It's not really oaky, so it doesn't have that kind of oak intrusion
right.
that's going to get in the way of food. And it's, you know, again, $12 a bottle. That's the most expensive you'll see it for. Often on sale for $9.99, and then you got buy a case, you're looking at $8.50 or something.
It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, so you know, in a weird way, we're kind of living in a golden age for wine. If you look at affordable wine, there is more really good affordable wine out there, that I think, than has ever been the case, you know, in the history of making wine. Just because, you know, technology has gotten rid of a lot of the truly awful inexpensive wines. You
right,
get a lot of generic
right,
inexpensive, right. you know, bland stuff, but you don't get things that are just, you know, I don't know if you remember.
God awful. Really
yeah,
terrible.
You just open yeah. up, you open the yeah. bottle and take a sip, you're like, whoa, yeah. that was not yeah. good. A lot of that's gone. So.
Well, you know, that's considering, you know, the economy, it's wonderful to have good news.
yeah, that's right.
yeah. Ray, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Lynn. Thanks very much.
The inimitable Ray Isle is executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Now, for his Thanksgiving wine picks, head to the website, splendidtable.org. And as you're roaming the website, see the latest edition of our ebook. The timing couldn't be better. It's Italian Holidays, Eating In with Lynn. It's a full-fledged menu with all sorts of extras. Let me tell you, this can take you from Thanksgiving right to the new year. And there's something here for everybody, no matter what they prefer to eat. It's all at splendidtable.org. Thanksgiving without pie borders on the unthinkable. So does not checking in with Southern baker Cheryl Day. She and her husband Griffith have the Back in the Day bakery in Savannah. Their retro and Southern desserts are a great fit. Cheryl joins us from Savannah. Cheryl, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
Okay, let me have a picture here. Here you are. You're in the South. Great food, fabulous bake stuff. And I want to know what's on your Thanksgiving table when it comes to dessert.
When it comes to dessert, it's all about the pie in our house. Pecan pie, sweet potato pie. Those are my two favorites. I do a bourbon pecan pie, and my special ingredient is sorghum, which is very popular. I grew up eating it. It's kind of a cross between like a caramelized molasses and honey, I would describe it. And it is delicious. And just a little bit, as you would maybe a little bit of molasses in a recipe, it just works out really great. And I actually do that in both of those pies.
Oh, so sorghum goes into the sweet potato pie too?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how do you do your sweet potato pie? Do you add cream to the potatoes, or what's the deal? What's the filling like?
Actually, I add cream and all kinds of spices. To me, it's all about the spices and eggs. It's, you know, it's got the basic stuff, cream and eggs. But I love playing with flavors. I think a lot of times people are afraid to play with flavors, but I just really love to do that. You know, add everything from cardamom to ginger and, you know, allspice and cloves, all the good stuff that reminds you of Thanksgiving.
Oh, that would be wonderful with sweet potatoes. So the sweet potatoes are pureed, and then you essentially are making it the way you'd make a pumpkin pie. You're making a custard.
Exactly like a pumpkin pie. The only thing is that, you know, a lot of people don't process their pumpkins, but you do have to bake the potato first. And that's the only thing that you have to do, but you can prepare in advance to do that, so it works out great.
So, okay, now we get to the thing that spooks so many people at this time of year. Tell me about your pie crust. What
okay.
do you do, and what's the secret or secrets?
Well, I do have a lot of secrets, but here's the thing. I do a couple of different crusts. There's one that I do that is an old-fashioned flaky crust that you do need a rolling pin and all that good stuff, and a little bit of skill, I would say. But then to that, I decided that I wanted to make fearless pie bakers. So I came up with a crust that is a press-in pie crust, but no one will ever know, because you can kind of, you know, crimp the edges or pinch them with a fork.
Right, right.
And, you know, it just looks, it's flaky, just like a, you know, a regular old-fashioned crust that you have to roll. So that's something that I like to recommend to people, especially if they are kind of, you know, there's that fear of making the pie crust.
Okay, now you know what I'm going to ask you. Can you step us through this present pie crust?
Okay, well, I actually call it a shortcut pie crust. And basically, all you do is you throw all of your dry ingredients into the bowl, the flour, the sugar, and the salt. And then you've got melted butter, and with a fork, kind of like how you would do a graham cracker crust, you'll just kind of mix it together until it looks kind of moist and crumbly.
Right.
And then all you're going to do, it's just so funny to even say it really is a shortcut, is that you just dump that into your pie pan.
That's it.
And then you'll press it out, just, you know, kind of going up the sides. And then the great cheat is that you can actually crimp the edges or make them really decorative and rustic. And there you have it.
And
you
that's
can either
it?
That's it. And I've got two ways of doing it. Sometimes I'll use brown sugar, and sometimes I'll use granulated sugar. But I tend to go for the brown sugar this time of year just because I love that
taste.
Extra molasses.
Yeah. You could throw spices in there too, right?
You could do whatever you want.
That is so brilliant. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, I just know from my experience that it just has made a world of difference with people, at least, you know, not being afraid, and God forbid they get like a store-bought crust, so they don't have to now.
Love it. Love it. Cheryl Day, thank you. You are our savior.
Thank you for having me.
Cheryl Day is co-author with her husband, Griffith, of the Back in the Day Bakery Cookbook. Now, find their recipes for that shortcut pie crust, bourbon pecan pie, and sweet potato pie at splendidtable.org. We have an invitation to Thanksgiving dinner. The Kitchen, that site beloved by home cooks, is partnering with the Splendid Table and creating a Thanksgiving menu especially for all of us. Now, if you know the Kitchen site, you know that it has a countless number of tested recipes, a troubleshooting column, new finds, and one section I particularly enjoy, kitchen tours. That is home kitchens done on all kinds of budgets. Well, Faith Durand is behind all of this. She's executive editor of the Kitchen. Faith, it is so good to have you with us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. We're really delighted to be here. And I say we because it's me, but I'm definitely here on behalf of all of us at the Kitchen.
Well, you know, that's what I want to know. How many of you are the Kitchen? No, because you guys do so much. I mean, you do everything from kitchen tours to all kinds of, you know, ideas for design and finds and recipes. Do you have sort of a base camp, you know, a central kitchen?
We don't have a central test kitchen, so we're not really like a magazine in that sense. There are five or six of us who are full-time or part-time on the editorial staff, and we're all over the country. And then we work with a big pool of freelancers as well. But we're all cooking in our own home kitchens.
And this is really about home food as opposed to restaurant food.
It is.
I wonder, because the recipes have different tones to them.
Yes.
Are there people who tend to, I mean, like, for instance, if you tell me to roast, I'll follow you anywhere. You know, I mean, are there people you like to, as executive editor, say, this is bread, and I know so-and-so is dynamite.
Yes, that would be our recipe editor, Emma Christensen, who is our bread expert. She also brews beer and many other things. And then if we need something that's very classically Southern, I go to our recipe developer, Neely, who's in Atlanta, and she's our, you know, tailgating Southern food, fried food expert. You know, and then there's Emily in L.A., who she tends to eat almost exclusively vegan and gluten-free, and so we have that voice as well. And it's a very diverse team, and that's a lot of the fun of working together.
Well, let's talk. You have designed, you've created for us, a Thanksgiving menu.
Yes.
Now, I want you to talk specifically about the menu, but where did you begin with this? What was the concept behind it?
Well, you know, I think that we often think of Thanksgiving as the giant Norman Rockwell dinner. And I grew up going to Cleveland for Thanksgivings, where my grandmother lives. And we'd usually have like 40 or 45 people across three tables and two rooms and and dogs. And it was just an absolutely enormous feast. And I really love that. But I think that, you know, as people get older or they're busier or they're maybe living in a city and can't go home for Thanksgiving, they want to have something at their own table, something that they can fit into a small house or a small apartment without too much prep, something smaller, something swankier, because it's going to just be grown-ups, maybe, you know, just a smaller group. So that was really what we were thinking for this. It has all the most pleasurable parts of the meal without being just enormous and taking a week to do.
And it's all make-ahead, right?
It's very make-ahead. I think that's something that people don't realize about Thanksgiving dinner, is how many of the favorite dishes are very make-ahead.
Okay, so what is the menu?
The menu starts with a few small bites, because nobody wants to fill up before Thanksgiving dinner, but it's nice to have something in people's hands, something delicious. So we start with just some shrimp. You know, you can just buy at the store and defrost with a little bit of sauce, and gougères, which are a lovely, crunchy, they're basically a fancy cheese puff. And if you've never made them, you really need to make them, because they're wonderful. And they can be made ahead. You can make them months ahead and freeze them, and you just bake them straight out of the freezer.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't it so easy? And then for the menu itself, we have just a small turkey. And Emma has created a really wonderful turkey recipe we use on the site. It's basically set it and forget it. I think if you can do so many great things to a turkey, but in the end, all you really need to do is put it in the oven and bake it. And that's what we do with this. It's not a big deal.
Well, the reality is there's so much else on the table. I always think the turkey's a minor event.
I do too. So, and then, you know, we hit all the other big pieces. We have a very classic bread stuffing. I always call it stuffing, even though I know it's not baked in the turkey, so it should be called dressing, but I call it stuffing. So
you're not that technical here.
Yeah, it's a sage and onion stuffing. It's sort of like the classic ones you'd get out of the box, but all homemade, and you can make it the day before. We have a cranberry sauce. We do golden mashed potatoes with a little bit of rutabaga in them to give them this really beautiful golden color and a little more, you know, taste. And we do a Brussels sprout salad. It has a brown butter dressing on it.
Ooh, that sounds great.
It's wonderful. And you can make it the night before. It actually gets better as it sits in the fridge. And then we have rolls. We have sweet potato rolls, which they take the sweet potato place on the table in this menu. So it's a pretty simple menu. It's very do-ahead. It's really great for 6 to 8 people.
How about dessert?
Well, dessert, we go a little more off script for dessert, because I wanted it, again, very make-ahead. We do, actually, instead of pie, we're doing a pumpkin maple creme brulee. And this is a no-bake creme brulee. It's just a quick pudding. You can make several days ahead, and then you just brulee it at the end of dinner. And then we serve that also with a very dark, damp gingerbread cake, which I love.
Oh, boy.
And a quince sorbet. Quince is a fruit I feel like doesn't get enough love around this time of year. We really adore it at the kitchen. Again, you can make it weeks ahead if you prefer.
Hey, I can't wait to do this. And thanks to the kitchen and the whole gang for giving us such a great Thanksgiving feast.
Oh, thank you for letting us share.
You take care, Faith, and have a great one.
Thank you. You too, Lynn.
Faith Durand is executive editor of The Kitchen. Now you can find The Kitchen's small and swanky Thanksgiving menu on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back to take your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Try and call your phone, but you're
It is time to connect with you. We're taking your calls. You can reach us 800-537-5252. Get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to splendidtable.org and shoot us an email. Steve's on the line from Lafayette, Indiana. Steve, what is on your mind?
Oh, I want to talk about hops and Thanksgiving.
Hops and Thanksgiving?
Yes.
Are we making beer for Thanksgiving?
There will probably be homebrew, yes. But I actually have some friends who are homebrewers who are also growing their own hops. And wanting to figure out how to use them in stuffing and maybe some other dishes as well.
There's a bitter edge to the hops. Well, you'll taste them and you'll know.
Yes.
You know, because that's one of the things that gives beer its characteristic flavor. But I know that in Belgium, for instance, you know, which produces, what, 300 to 400 beers? Mm-hmm. Beer is a big deal there. People sauté them. When they're first, you know, those first buds of them, when they're still very small and quite tender, they're sautéed in butter with a bit of cream. And, of course, the butter, the Belgians, by the way, have never seen any reason to give up butter and cream. But the butter and cream sweetens or contrasts the snap of the hops, and it would really be delicious. Now, another thing that would be kind of fun to do with them is to do them in a mild sweet-sour combination. Maybe brown a little bit of onion and then boil down vinegar in that so that it's not, how can I put it? As you boil down vinegar, it tends to sweeten, okay?
Okay.
And if you use half balsamic and half like an apple cider vinegar, you'll get that bit of sweetness. You just want a bit of that syrup and then taste it. And if you need a little sugar, just stir a little sugar in it and just warm the hops in butter or oil, and then toss them with that. I think it would be delicious.
Wow. So are you talking a side dish or as a sauce?
I think it's a side dish.
Okay.
It's a side dish, yes. Definitely a side dish.
So I was thinking of maybe using it as a substitute for sage in stuffing. Would that be...
Oh, I had never thought about that. They may be very strong, but see how they taste. I think it's a great idea. It's worth experimenting with. I've never tried it.
Well, neither have we, but we hope to do a lot of it this year.
It's going to be a great Thanksgiving.
I hope so. Thank you.
You take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
We've got Lila calling from Grand Junction, Colorado. Lila, what is on your mind, ma'am?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
So for Thanksgiving, I am wanting to make cinnamon glazed sweet potatoes and Yukon Gold mashed potatoes.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to make scalloped potatoes. But that's a lot of potatoes. So I was wondering if there's another scalloped vegetable dish. I was thinking of a root vegetable.
Well, a gratin or a scallop is very similar. And you could do it with turnips. You could do it with rutabaga. You could do it with, kohlrabi would be wonderful. Kohlrabi is really neutral. It's really delicious, too. You know, it's in the cabbage family. And I love it. I just love it. So I could, you know what you could do? I just got an idea. Why not do a turnip kohlrabi scallop or gratin? And the idea there is that you really butter a shallow baking dish really well, okay? Mm-hmm. You overlap a layer of whichever one you want to do first, okay? And then you dot it with little bits of butter, some nutmeg, fresh grated nutmeg, salt and pepper, okay? And then you keep doing that, going all the way up to the top. And then you can pour in a combination of rich broth and cream, okay? Some people like to do just straight broth, but it should be a homemade broth because if it's a canned one, it's going to get so salty, you know, you'll think you're going to plots. Oh, slivers of garlic between those layers are really great. And you cover that and you put it into like a 350-degree oven, and you want to cook it for at least an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, until they're just beginning to get tender, and then you uncover it. And you've just moistened this. You haven't drowned it, right? You uncover and you let it finish cooking so that it's all golden brown on the top. And if you need a few extra flakes of butter, go for it. It's Thanksgiving. And if you want, when you heat it up, because this will be delicious 2 days later, just delicious, is when you heat it up, sprinkle some shredded cheese on it, some Asiago or some Gruyere, something like that. okay? Or you could even do some of that garlic herb creamy cheese on top, which is too sexy for words. Yes, exactly. And that way, you'll have something that really celebrates what winter's about, and it won't be a potato. So
that's perfect.
And it'll be fabulous. So I think that you're home free.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a great holiday.
You too.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Tom's on the line from Youngstown, Ohio. Tom, hi. What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to roast a leg of lamb outdoors on a spit over a fire.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And, you mean over like a real fire as opposed to charcoal briquettes?
Right.
Ah, okay.
I'd like to know what type of wood would taste best with lamb and mm-hmm. what combination of wood and spices would be best.
Well, first of all, you want a hardwood. Some people love to use fruit wood, so that would mean apple, cherry wood. What do you have access to is the first question.
Apple and cherry are the two that I have, you know, the best access to.
Okay. This is what I think you want to do, first of all. And by the way, you're going to roast over hot coals. So you want to build the fire in a way that you're going to let it cook down and you've got the hot coals and you've got a really thick bed of them, you know, about, 6 inches deep. And you're going to feed the fire, but you're going to feed the fire from the outside so you don't have flames licking under that spit.
Okay.
And you want the lamb elevated above that fire by about 10 inches or more. Okay? And you're going to use a meat thermometer. And, of course, a lot of this is going to be guesswork. It depends on the temperature outside. You're in Youngstown, Ohio, so maybe you want to get it down a little closer to the fire. Otherwise, it's going to take a very, very, very long time. So here's the deal. I would use, if you've got a lot of it, I would do it completely over the fruit wood. And it's going to probably take a couple of hours. And you want to build up a really deep bed of hot coals. And you want to drip pan underneath the lamb. And then the coals are around it. And you're going to keep turning it and you're going to keep basting it. Now, from the pan drippings, but you can also be basting it with wine, with whatever you think you want. Now, you could do, if you've got apple wood, it would be interesting to do a combination of apple cider and white wine and herbs. You know, one of the things that's lovely is to brush it with a bouquet of fresh thyme and rosemary. You may not get a ton of flavor from that, but it's very romantic. But you can flavor, you know, by if you take the lamb the day before and you make deep, deep pockets in it and you stuff it with the herbs that you want to taste or with the flavors you want to taste. Now, it may be that you want to cut up apples and you want some shallots in there and you want some spices that please you. That'll start to permeate the lamb. You leave that in the fridge overnight. But I do a slow turn on the spit. And if you want the lamb medium rare, you want it at around 130 when you take it off, 125 to 130 when you take it off the spit, and then you let it rest for about 10 minutes. I would do that around 130 at the very most, only because, well, you have to see what the center of the lamb is, because the center of the lamb is going to be the most important thing. At the thickest part of the meat, if the center of the lamb is at about 130, then the outside is going to be much more done. But since it's a triangular shaped piece of meat, everybody's going to get something different. Some part of it's going to be well done, some part of it's going to be rare, some part of it's going to be medium rare. And know what you can do? You can bury the sides in the coals. Potatoes, artichokes, onions, apples, I mean, you name it, whole vegetables. It'd be fabulous.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Well, thank you, Tom. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email, splendidtable.org, or you can call us 800-537-5252. If you want an idea of where food can take us these days, take a look at an Indian chef, Vikas Khanna. He has a Michelin-starred restaurant in New York City, Janoon. He's authored an armload of books, and he hosts MasterChef's India
All fine accomplishments. But like many of his colleagues, philanthropy seems to be his main aim. For instance, Sakiv is his international relief and awareness organization. And Holy Kitchens made him a filmmaker. It's a series on holy places where beliefs and food come together. Vikas joins us from India. Vikas, it's good to have you back.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
The last time we spoke, you told us about this film project that you're doing called Holy Kitchens.
Yes.
And you have now interviewed the Dalai Lama for this.
Yes, I did.
Please tell me about that experience, because you're talking to people who are essentially religious people about the meaning of food. Is that basically what Holy Kitchens is about?
The concept comes from my homeland, where they have a temple. It's a center of Sikhism, which is called the Golden Temple in Amritsar. It's in north of India, right on the border of India and Pakistan. So they have this huge temple in which they have a community kitchen, in which everything is for free. You know, everyone who grows their crops donates. Everyone who serves there is a volunteer, and everyone who cooks there is a volunteer. And I was always so emotionally attached to it because, first of all, I learned how to roll breads there. And secondly, in my hometown, they say that no one ever sleeps hungry. So I just felt so great that if everyone contributes a little bit, you can eradicate the world's one of the greatest problems is hunger, especially in third world countries.
So you had an opportunity to speak to the Dalai Lama.
I spent a whole week with him. Now, can you beat that, how lucky I must feel about
myself?
Oh, my
Lord, yeah, exactly. So what did he have to say about food?
He said a prayer. He says that every grain is a sacrifice of life. May I be worthy of this sacrifice. May my unwholesome qualities turn to wholesome because I'm consuming life. It's beautiful. And, you know, I think that the beauty of being around him, that it makes you so conscious of life that you're living and the gratefulness and that you're breathing and you start feeling that you're breathing and this is such a great moment that you are alive and why am I complaining, you know? It's like he gives you that whole feeling about understanding the conscience on a very different level. One thing which I had learned very profound from him was that he said that everyone needs food. Food is life. He's saying we come from food and we are consumed in the end. We could be consumed by fire, by earth, by anything. He's saying we come from food. I think, I don't know how many books I would write in future, but I promise you there will be some quotation which has influenced me by just being around him about food.
Mm-hmm.
He also sent a foreword for my upcoming book. It's a simple foreword, but the way he explained the whole thing about journey and food and the lost traditions, that he says that through food, you can see a whole culture. If you are always sharing family-style food, it means that the culture is about binding together in so many ways. And all the rich cultures had pre-plated food. So I thought that was quite interesting that a man with that status is looking at these details about our civilization. And I think any chef who would see what he has written would be a little influenced wow, I should be so grateful that I have the opportunity to feed so many people every single day.
I'm remembering something I heard at a wake, and they said there are places in the world where you define family by the people you eat with.
Yes.
And blood relation has nothing to do with it. Very interesting.
Nothing to do with it.
Vikas, thank you. And I can't wait to see the book.
My honor.
Vikas Khanna's book is Khanna Sutra, Food Lessons in Love. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. May you have a great turkey day. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Ken Hubbard, who said, a lot of Thanksgiving days have been ruined by not carving the turkey in the kitchen. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Well, head to our website to get information on anything you heard here today. You can browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our latest e-book, Italian Holidays, Eating In With Lynn. It's all there for you at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.